Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Vivian Howard is one of the most unlikely TV stars in recent memory. She came back home to Kinston, North Carolina, after burning out in the restaurant world of New York City. She and her husband started their own little place in Kinston. PBS found them, and the resulting show, A Chef's Life, was a huge hit that gave viewers a long look at a world that was distinctly Southern, but never stereotypical.
We wanted to portray the South and the people of Eastern North Carolina in particular as the like multi-dimensional human beings that they are. They're not mystical fairies and they're not bumbling idiots, and they have a skill set and a type of wisdom that people in urban areas may not have.
Now Howard has decided that a chef's life should come to an end. You'll hear her talking about the final episode, which aired after our interview, but is available online. She's got a new show and a new cookbook in the works. And on the day we talked, she was dealing with a flooding in her part of the world from Hurricane Florence and Hurricane Michael. Here's our conversation. So, Vivian Howard, you went to the state fair yesterday. What did you eat?
Basically, someone in my group was eating something at all times. So we had corn dogs, cheeseburger, these fries that really reminded me more of chips, but they were all clustered together.
So like one big chunk of French fried stuff.
Right, and you just pull it apart. Also some fries that looked like they had been cut with a spiralizer.
Yeah.
And another type of fry that was just regular. I had a caramel peanut apple. My daughter got cotton candy. Everyone in our group got ice cream except for me. We had an $8 strawberry lemonade. There's no alcohol in it.
Really?
Just
$8.
Yeah. I had this giant turkey leg that I've always looked at, but I've never consumed.
Sort of the Renaissance Festival turkey leg.
Yes, and it was very tasty, but the whole time I was eating it, I was thinking, I'm going to be so puffy tomorrow, because I could tell it was like cured and very salty, but very tasty.
So when you have stuff like that, now are you ever analyzing it as a chef? You're like, oh, that turkey leg could have used a little more, you know, cumin. I don't even know what spices to talk about here, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I generally turn that off when I'm at like the fair.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you get any ideas, like something you might want to try?
No.
Well, it's how we were talking a little bit before, and you said that's all the state fair you need for a while, right?
Yes. But I'm glad I did it, and my children certainly enjoyed it.
Did they sleep on the way back, or were they all wound up from?
They were very agitated from all the sugar, I think.
Yeah, I think it's sort of the purpose of the state fair is to provide like a maximum amount of sugar for little kids to sort of, you know, get them wound up for the rest of the day.
Well, it worked.
It worked. Great. Well, I want to talk about other fun stuff too later, but I want to talk a little bit about the floods in Eastern North Carolina. Now, I remember covering like Hurricane Floyd, I think, way back like 99, 2000. And I remember back then, Kinston was a place that always got flooded, that area of the state because of the rivers there and just that low-lying ground. So, you know, and obviously, you guys, like most North Carolina, got hit twice over the last few weeks. What was that like for kind of you personally and then for sort of the larger community there?
Well, for me personally and, you know, my home and our restaurants, we're totally fine. Except, you know, I've been asked this question so many times in the past few weeks, and it's not a black and white answer, because although we didn't flood and there was no loss of life, you know, it makes it really hard to do business when you're closed for 2 weeks in all your locations, you know. And then there's a ripple effect because a lot of your employees are not working and many of them are hourly employees. And so when this happens year after year, it becomes a, hostile place to live and work, if you will.
Right.
So, but we were very grateful not to have any real damage. But right around us, you know, Jones County, Duplin County, Craven County,
sure.
Those places are really, the devastation is unprecedented there. And Jones County is one of the most rural, poor counties in the state. And, you know, schools were decimated. You know, Pollocksville, like 90% of the population is homeless. And it's not a community that people really talk about because it is so rural. And but it is one that we should absolutely be thinking about.
And I also wondered, because, you know, your show has been so much about local ingredients and local farmers and all, did any of the farmers get especially hit? It seemed like the fall is a lot sort of a transition time, I know. But did, like, have greens been planted out there yet and that sort of thing? Did any crops get damaged?
Yes. Well, you know, it's not as bad for them as it would have been if this hit in, like, June,
right.
You know. But absolutely, these early and late fall crops, particularly greens, really suffered, flooded, drowned, I guess. And then Warren, who has been on the show probably
sure.
more than anyone else, he and his wife remodeled this little house on their farm. They call it the Little Blue Shack. And they had been renting it out for, you know, as an Airbnb, and a tree fell on it. And it's, I don't think it's going to be able to, I don't think it's going to be the Little Blue Shack anymore on Airbnb.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it's not good for anyone.
Right. And I know you're selling, or you're, you know, sort of spearheaded selling these Country as Cornbread t-shirts that are through the end of October, right?
Yes, yes. They're t-shirts that we designed, and they just say Country as Cornbread. They're very soft, and they're $25. They'll cost me about $10 when it's all said and done. And so $15 at least will go to the North Carolina Communities Foundation, and that money will be earmarked for the residents of Jones County who lost their homes. So, it's amazing. I participate in a lot of fundraisers as a chef. You know, we are always going to, you know, cook at a benefit or do an auction lot dinner. And there's a lot of back end work that goes into those types of events and a lot of investment. And this t-shirt thing is something I just kind of dreamt up and just printed 100 shirts and passed them around to friends of mine so that they can wear them for promotion. And then we're not printing any shirts until they're ordered. So it's like was not a major investment in time or money to get this started. And we've sold over 3,000 shirts.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's crazy. I was like, oh, no.
Now we actually have to do something with this,
yeah.
Right? That's fantastic. Well, I know we're catching you here, you know, at sort of a time of transition as well. So the chef's life, you know, which so many people love, including a couple of people in this room who are watching us today, is wrapping up. And I know you're going to start some new things. We'll talk about those in a second. First, I just wanted to ask, what kind of led to the decision to end a chef's life now?
Well, we've made 5 seasons of A Chef's Life, but we've been working on the show for about 7 years. And you know, when we started making it, it was not my plan to be in it. And I wanted to produce it, and I wanted it to be about the farmers and food artisans in Eastern North Carolina. And but I ended up being the subject of it. And, you know, after 7 years of having every personal and professional triumph and tragedy captured on camera, I feel like it's time to evolve. And, you know, every episode of A Chef's Life is about one ingredient, a quintessential Southern ingredient. And
you're kind of running out of ingredients.
We've kind of done all of them, you know, where we start pulling things that don't really make sense out of a hat, you know. And my interest as a chef and a storyteller has evolved. And I think it's really important, you know, I tell people that the show's ending and the reaction I get is that someone in their family has died. So I want everyone to understand that this was not something that we were flippant about. You know, I don't want to make this show anymore because I'm incredibly grateful for all of it. But I feel like it's time to tell new stories. And also my children are 7 years old, and they've been on camera since they were 2 months old. And I don't want them – this is something I've imposed on them. And I want – if they want to be on TV, I want it to be their choice. But I don't think they're capable of making that choice just yet.
And how did that decision – was that like a kind of decisions with you and your husband first, kind of talking about that? How did that – you know, how did you get from, you know, doing the show to saying, I don't want to do it this way anymore? Did that kind of start with kind of in the house decisions first?
No, Ben would be happy if we continued doing the show, I think. But it's something I've been feeling for quite some time. Yeah. And I just started talking about it about 2 years ago and kind of pitching to our team the idea that I had for a new series. And honestly, I think I was kind of bullheaded about it.
Right.
Like, I'm not going to do this anymore. And I regret the way that I handled it. Absolutely. But, you know, sometimes there are these lines that appear in the sand.
Sure.
And you didn't even draw them.
Yeah. Was there a moment for you when you said, oh, this is now. Now's the moment when I think we probably need to kind of wrap this up?
A series of moments, because, you know, when we first started making the show, I was working in the restaurant every day and night, and a lot of the show is filmed in the restaurant, and I don't work in the restaurant every night anymore, and I don't want to go in with our cameras and act as if I am, and because there are people who are working in the restaurant every night, and I want them to have the credit that they're due. So it was a series of events like that where I realize that in order for me to be an authentic storyteller, which is one of the things that people really respond to, then I'm going to have to be authentically learning and on this path that I am actually on.
Yeah. I was just a couple of questions about, you know, that, and I want to go on to the new thing, but do your kids realize that there are kids who don't get followed around by TV cameras?
Yes, but just recently. You know, I'd say when they turned like 5, they started figuring out that not everybody had a TV show about their life.
Yeah.
And there was that realization, and then the slow kind of realization that they were special because
right.
of it. And that's really what I want to avoid. Our children should know that they are not special.
Right, trying to figure that out. Well, it's funny. A couple of weeks ago, Brooklyn Decker was here, and we talked about, she has two very young kids. I guess, you know, probably around the ages of when your kids were when you started the show. And she was talking about trying to figure out, you know, how much of their lives do I show? I think mainly for her, it's like on her Instagram mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. And how much do I keep for myself? Has that been something that you've had to deal with and sort of struggle with these last few years?
Yeah, just figuring out at what point am I quote-unquote exploiting my children.
Right.
And when they're 25, how are they going to feel about it?
They're going to write their tell-all memoirs.
Right, right. We've already told it all on TV. But, you know, I enjoy sharing my children on, like, Instagram, and I feel like I'm in control of that. And my children are really funny. And the most entertaining part about my life. So I do tend to share them on Instagram. And they're into it.
All right. Oh, great. it struck me as I was kind of looking through some old episodes and stuff that you have this really interesting thing in that, you know, everybody has sort of a family album of their kids. But you have this, you know, hundreds of hours of video now of your kids that you can go back and look at. And I wonder if you ever go back and look at old shows just to see like how they've changed or anything
like that.
Well,
one year, I think maybe 2 years ago, I asked the editor, Tom Vickers of the show, to put together a file of all the moments with the children to date on the show. And I gave it to Ben and my dad for Father's Day. And
did you watch that?
Yeah, yeah. And it's amazing to watch your children really grow up in a beautifully edited.
I was going to say, they're lit perfectly, right?
Yeah, it's not like me shooting it with my iPhone, but there's music set to it. And
so what was it like to kind of do that, you know, show, wrapping it up? Because I think when most people say goodbye to something or friends or whatever, you know, you have a few hugs and yes, but yours is by necessity sort of it's a show, and there's all this other stuff going on as you're doing it. How did that sort of play into? How did you deal with all that? I guess is the question.
Well,
or are you kind of used to all that by now?
Well, it's kind of what the whole series has been. You know, I've cooked, you know, for 400 people in Oxford, Mississippi, you know, this career defining event. And it should be for, you know, most chefs, just that. But for me, it's also about making a TV show at the same time.
Right.
And so I feel like, for me, it's been very hard to separate the reality of the show from my own reality,
right.
Which is one of the reasons that I felt like I needed to do something else.
Yeah. Have you had moments where you felt like, I wish this wouldn't have been on camera, or things that you've maybe done but haven't told the producers about because you're like, I just want to keep this one for myself?
No. Because I have this, I want to tell the best stories that we can. And
sure.
So if I'm doing something cool or something important or something, you know, that has the opportunity to teach, I feel a responsibility to give Cynthia, the director, the opportunity to film it if she thinks that it's worthwhile. So I've been very selfless in that way.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when you watch the show and you see us on Christmas morning or Thanksgiving, that's really Christmas morning.
Yeah.
And
so it's there's a minimum of staging is what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah, there's no staging.
Right.
I mean, you know, I don't even put on makeup most of the time.
Right.
And so you know, that's not only Christmas morning for me and my family, but it's Christmas morning for the crew. And their families, and they're having to, you know, share that that important day with the rest of the world, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about the new project you've got together. Do you have an official name for that yet, or are you still working on it?
We had a name, but the name got shot down. But I mean, that's kind of brutal sounding, but it was going to be called South by Somewhere, but PBS felt that was too close to South by Southwest.
The festival in Austin, yeah.
But we argued that, but we didn't win. So we're back to the drawing board on names. Names are hard to come up to get the right one.
And explain what this show, kind of the concept for this one.
Okay, so, you know, every episode of A Chef's Life was about an ingredient. And every episode of this new show is going to be about one of these dishes that every culture shares. So every culture has a dumpling. Every culture has their way of cooking greens or a chicken and rice dish. And so we'll touch on my culture's version briefly, but then I will learn from a friend of mine who lives in the South, not necessarily Eastern North Carolina. We will spend some time there, but we also go elsewhere in the South. And that person is of another culture. So we filmed with a Latino family who lives in Kinston and has worked with me forever. We filmed with a friend of mine who's Korean. We filmed with a friend of mine who's Lumbee Indian. We went down to South Carolina and filmed on Edisto Island with Geechee Gullah.
Sure.
Cook. So it's not all immigrants in the immigrant, the way you think of it sense, but really it's like all the people who make up the South and what the South looks like. And hopefully it's a way to show us how we're all more alike than we are different.
Yeah. Well, that's one thing I wanted to kind of get into with you, because our podcast is kind of about the South and how it shaped the guests and how they see the world. And it struck me that one of the things about your show is that it's given people this vision of the South. And I think partly because of your background, because you grew up in Eastern North Carolina, but then you went away and then came back and sort of saw your homeland, I guess, in a new light. Correct me if I'm wrong about
it. No, you're right.
And there's, you know, there are Southern accents in the show. You have a really nice Southern accent. Your guests and your regulars and your family all have these great Southern accents. But there's sophisticated ideas in the show. And I guess I just wonder what you think the story that you guys have told maybe about the South has been like over these last few years and how you want to continue that in this new show.
Right. Well, so we have been very strategic.
I'm sorry for the long question.
No. We've been very strategic about the story that we wanted to tell about the South because, unfortunately, I think when people make content or television about the South, it's generally someone not from the South who drops in with an idea of the story they want to tell. They find some way to tell that story, and then they leave. So we wanted to portray the South and the people of Eastern North Carolina in particular as the, like, multidimensional human beings that they are. They're not mystical fairies, and they're not bumbling idiots, and they have a skill set and a type of wisdom that people in urban areas may not have. And so we wanted to show Eastern North Carolina as a place that's full of human beings. And I think that we were successful in doing that.
When we come back, Vivian Howard talks about the difference between who she is in real life and who she is on TV. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
If you've watched A Chef's Life very much, you probably know that the show's theme song is Will You Return by the Avett Brothers. One of the first episodes of Southbound was an interview with Dolph Ramser, who discovered the Avetts and is still their manager.
And I remember, you know, it was part folk, part punk rock, and everybody had a smile on their face, and the guys were a little ragged, but there was something there.
If you're liking this conversation with Vivian Howard, you'll probably like our talk with Dolph, too. You can find the archives of every Southbound episode on WFAE.org, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Each week on Southbound, we take a moment to highlight some of our favorite listeners. This week, I want to thank Joanne Joy, who said this about Southbound on Twitter. How I make the most of a dreadful commute on I-77 North. Smart, thoughtful, kind interviews always teach me something new about my native South. Thank you, Joanne. We are always glad to get anybody through their commute. If you enjoy the podcast, we want to hear from you. The best way is to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. That's a way for Apple to show us a little more love. You can also email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org or tweet at me at Tommy Tomlinson. If you subscribe to us on your favorite podcast provider, we'll send you new episodes of Southbound as soon as they come out. Thank you for your support. Now, back to our conversation with Vivian Howard. Do you think this show would have been different or even possible had you not gone away and done these other things and then come back? Like, if you had just grown up in Kinston and started a restaurant there and it was successful and PBS found you one day, you know what I mean? Like, what? How is the life path you've had made it different?
Not at all. First of all, if I had never left home, I don't know what I'd be doing. I definitely probably wouldn't be running a restaurant in Kinston and on TV.
Right.
But I think that going away and living elsewhere really gave me the perspective to understand Eastern North Carolina as actually a cool place with a defined culture and deep traditions, because I didn't understand that was special or important until going somewhere else and seeing that it didn't exist there.
Right. I want to kind of dig into that just a little bit because, you know, your story, that kind of journey, is such a familiar story that's been told. And it's sort of the plot of Midnight Train to Georgia in a way. You know, somebody goes away. Life doesn't work out quite the way they wanted it to there. Then they come back and they're faced with, you know, living in their old place and all the memories they have of it and then the new things they bring to it. When you first got back, like, what was your attitude like and how did you see the place, you know, that you grew up? And then maybe, if anything changed, sort of what changed your view of it?
When I first moved back, I was very fatigued by living in the city. So, you know, I tell this story that Ben and I, you know, we went to the Food Lion in Pink Hill and all the produce looked better than it did at the Green Market in Union Square, which
right.
is not possible. You know? But we were just so happy to have made a life change and to be there that we had on these rose colored glasses. But then, you know, we'd been there for a few months and we're trying to open the restaurant and I'm fixated on the idea of educating our customer base on, you know, fine food and fine wine and fine service. And really, I would say in an arrogant kind of condescending sort of way. And I can say that because I'm talking about myself. But, you know, after, you know, running the restaurant a while and realizing that what I was doing was not really working and it was not resonating with our customers, I, you know, kind of looked inward and started paying attention to the people around me and going to church and looking at what was on the covered dish table and, you know, buffets and the steam table and places I would never have normally looked for inspiration. And realizing that there was a fully formed cuisine right in front of me and that I could probably learn a lot from it. So it was not initial, you know, when I first moved back, like, aha. But I was right. conditioned to, I think, eventually understand the value of it.
And if I understand right, there was a lot of, when you started out on this the path you had, there was a lot of fear in your family, too. Like, they wanted you to start a steakhouse or something, right?
Yes, yes. The idea was that we would open a fine dining restaurant and the centerpiece of it would be steak and baked potato and there would need to be a salad bar somewhere. And then when I, you know...
With iceberg lettuce.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
But when Ben and I decided that you know, we said, we never intended to do that. My parents actually tried to hire another chef.
To like supervise you or to like...
To help me. They just didn't think I could do it. And I can say that because I know they won't listen to this podcast.
and so...
But sometimes the truth comes back to haunt you.
Yeah. And so at what point, do you remember a point when you felt like that they were sort of understood that you were going to be all right, that this was all going to work out for you?
I'd say shortly after we opened, they saw how committed we were to making it work and that we were, you know, working day and night and every day of the weekend and that we were not going to fail.
Yeah.
We may have to evolve and we may have to eventually put a steak and baked potato on the menu, but we were going to do whatever we needed to make sure that we didn't just give up the opportunity.
I read an interview with you from a few years ago where, you know, you said one of the things about being on PBS as opposed to like HBO or something is that you couldn't curse on the air, you know, these little things. And obviously it's a small thing. But I do wonder, like, and you were talking about how you want the show to be really authentic. You want it to be a really close version of you. What parts does the camera not quite capture of you, you think? Like when you look at shows, like what pieces of your personality don't quite make it in there?
Well, I'd say that I'm edgier than you see on TV. I used to have a really bad potty mouth because that's something that I learned in the kitchen. And I think it was a way for me to fit in. And but I don't have that anymore, mainly because I had to stop cussing on camera, so.
So, and I guess that's the kind of leads to the next question. Like, how do you feel like this has, you know, being on TV and all this stuff for so long has sort of shaped your personality? Like, do you see yourself now as a different person sort of off camera because of the way you've presented yourself on camera?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, being on television in this way and having young girls come up to me and, you know, tell me that I'm their role model, and having people come to me crying and saying that I remind them of where they came from and made them proud of that, you know, that comes with a lot of responsibility. So I feel responsibility to those people and to Eastern North Carolina and to all of my fans to be who it is they think I am.
Yeah. We were talking just before we the mics got turned on here. You were telling me about having gone to the state fair and feeling like it was a hard place for you to be in public because people see you and they notice and they like you. And I wonder how that has sort of affected your life and how you think about moving around in the world day to day.
Well, it's not...
I know Eastern North Carolina, that's the sweet spot, right?
Yeah, well, no, actually, I get approached far less in Eastern North Carolina than anywhere else.
Really?
Yes, it's like people there don't care. I'm not even sure that many people there watch the show.
Yeah.
But, you know, going airports and going anywhere in the Triangle, you know, I was in Oxford, Mississippi this past weekend. I got in an Uber and the driver said, "Oh my God, it's Vivian Howard." So you never really know. But it doesn't change much for me. It doesn't prevent me from doing things. It does annoy my children.
Right.
Because they're like, "Ah, Mom, we just wanted to go to the zoo and everybody wants to talk to you."
Right, right.
And then they're like, can I be in the picture too?
So they figured out a way to kind of get in there, right?
Yeah.
So when you were in New York working at restaurants, sort of getting by and enjoying it, part of it and not enjoying parts of it, did you see yourself as somewhere in particular 10 years from there? Like, what do you see yourself doing?
You know, I don't think I really knew. You know, growing up, I wanted to be a journalist.
Right.
And I was always incredibly outgoing and, like, the life of the party and, you know, always known as a comedian and a student government president, you know, and just very outgoing. And then when I moved to New York, and a lot of things didn't go as planned, and I did not become Katie Couric.
But that was sort of in your mind, like, boy, I'd love to do that one day.
Yes, yes. When that didn't happen, and I started cooking in restaurants, and the culture in a restaurant as a line cook is like, keep your head down and your mouth shut, and that's how you can be the most successful. And so I became really, really good at that. I really changed, I think, and I lost a lot of self-esteem, and I felt in a lot of ways as kind of like a failure, particularly when I had to move home after being in New York. And I was very much that same person when we started making the show. And so over the past 7 years of doing this, I've gained so much self-esteem, and I believe in myself. Sometimes I think too much. And I've found my voice again. And it's very hard for me to keep my head down and my mouth shut.
I didn't know this little part of your story about when you envisioned this show, Chef's Life, that you weren't going to be on it.
Right.
So what was the process that you ended up in front of the camera?
So we were going to film. I called Cynthia, who grew up right down the road from me, but lived in Durham at the time. And I called her and I said, "I want to make this documentary about the dying food traditions of Eastern North Carolina." And she said, "Okay, great. Let's experiment." And I had just, my children were 2 months old and I was still wearing maternity clothes. And I had on a green maternity dress the day that she and Rex, her partner, came down. And we were going to experiment with the tradition of putting up corn. It was July 4th weekend, and Deep Run had a 3-block parade. That means a parade that goes for three blocks.
And, so it's over in like 15 minutes.
Right. And it had a big corn float. And so they went and filmed that. And then we, my family and I, put up corn. And I guess in my mind, I just thought they would just like film us putting up corn and there would be a narrator and maybe I would be the narrator. I hadn't really thought about it that much. But because I was one of the people putting up corn, I just kept turning to the camera and explaining what we were doing and more or less really turning to Cynthia and explaining what we were doing. And that's just, that became what we did. She, after we shot that day, that next week she said, you know, I'm going to send you the file with all the footage and I need you to watch it. And it took me over a month to watch it because I just couldn't bring myself to look at it because I had not planned on doing it.
Right.
And I was really trying to decide without ever seeing it whether it's something I could be comfortable with. And boy, I wish I had not been wearing a maternity dress and lactating that day. Because it became the first episode of the show.
Oh, really? That, yeah. So that footage
yeah.
went right in there. Wow. Yeah. And did you have to sort of, I don't know, give yourself a pep talk or something to say, okay, I'm gonna do this. I'm going to be kind of out front in this.
Yeah, I remember the first season of the show had this cooking demo portion of it.
Sure.
Where we set up the restaurant like a studio on a Sunday, and I cooked a recipe from start to finish. And when we got ready to do that, I mean, I had never done anything like that before. And I remember they're setting up the cameras, and we're getting ready to start. And I'm like, what in the hell has happened? And, you know, I don't think I can do this. Can I do this? We started rolling, and I really was struggling. And stuttering and saying a lot, which I still do. And Rex, the director of photography, said, Vivian, even if you think you can't do this, act like you think you can. And I thought, okay, I can do that. And so that's what I've been doing.
Just a self portrait, basically.
Yeah.
I want to make clear to everybody who's listening that we did not ask Vivian to cook while she was here. But I wonder how many times when somebody asks you to do something or if you get invited to somebody's house or something, they say, you know, could you do a little something for it? I just wonder if it's like, you know, I've talked to magicians who every time they go somewhere, somebody wants them to do a trick. Do people want you to kind of do your tricks when you're...
I think they'd probably love for me to, but if they're familiar with me and the show, they know that I would bitch and moan about it in the background. So they don't ask.
Now, I've often heard, and somebody told me one time when I was starting out in my field that, you know, this job is always fun to do when you're happy and excited and want to do it. But the sign of a pro is doing the job when you don't feel like it.
Yeah.
So do you have a lot of days when you're like, man, if I have to cook one more thing or any of that sort of thing, you know, do you just kind of wonder and how do you make it through those days?
Well, you know, there are a lot of days when we're filming the show and there's I'm cooking and I'm being Vivian from A Chef's Life that I just do not want to do it and I don't feel well. And but you have to be like not only cooking, but you have to be like upbeat and full of energy and quick and funny. And I don't know how I managed to muster it up, but I feel a lot of responsibility to the crew. And so I try not to waste anyone's time because I don't want them to do that for me either.
And when you're done with that, do you just need to go like lay down somewhere for a little while?
I always tell people that I stare at a wall.
Yeah. And
yeah, I just have to be in silence. Like I don't watch television. I can't read after that. I can't talk on the phone or socialize. I just like to be alone.
So I know you also are working on, I guess, a new cookbook, right? Mm-hmm. And it seemed like you made me think of when we were talking about, you know, not wanting to do stuff or whatever, that I remember reading somewhere that you kind of get into things like mother guilt and body image and all that sort of thing. Is that accurate as to what this cookbook is going to be kind of wrapped around?
Or? Yes. So if Deep Run Roots, which was my first book, it's like a love letter or a document about, you know, Eastern North Carolina and our ingredients and our food ways, then this book would be a personal cookbook. So it's a narrative cookbook that, when I say a narrative cookbook, I mean there's an element of storytelling throughout that's more so than most cookbooks. That the narrative is about ambition and mommy guilt and body image and not believing in yourself and that sort of thing. And then the recipes are what I actually eat, you know, because I cook every day for myself and for my family and for my team at my office. But I don't spend all day doing it. I'd like to say like kind of healthy angle to it, but I'm not interested in eating anything healthy unless it tastes really good.
Right.
So it's not a diet book, if you will.
So what was an example of something you might cook in that sort of situation?
Okay, so one of the chapters in the book is called Beans Because I Want to Live to Be 100. And, you know, there's these, you know what a blue zone is?
Yeah, where everybody lives longer than normal.
Right. So there's these pockets of population all around the world
fascinates me.
Where people live to be more than 100 years old.
Sure.
And one of the common threads they can find between these populations is that they eat some kind of bean or legume every day.
Right.
And so I've become, like, obsessed with eating beans. And so there's a black bean burrito in its birthday suit, which means everything that would be in a black bean burrito without
tortilla.
Right, exactly. There's, you know, a white bean, tomato, and turnip green gratin, which is basically just kind of, those are baked, kind of like baked beans. And then there's a chapter that's called This Will Make It Taste Good. And these are all these little condiments that I make and keep in the refrigerator. And none of them are like fermented collard greens that take, you know, 6 weeks. But they're little things that I can whip up, like a peanut sauce that I call peanut crack. And I may need to rethink that name. So then there's another chapter called The Greener the Better. And it's just about how I hide a lot of green stuff in my kids' foods and in my own food and just trying to eat as many green things as possible. So.
Yeah. I wonder, and this will kind of wrap things up for us, you know, you were talking about the kind of your version of comfort food or whatever. Is there something in particular that when you are traveling, you're on the road, especially if you're not in the South, in a way that when you come back sort of ground you back at home, like something you feel like, boy, once I have this, I feel better?
Well, you know, it's almost my own cliche now, but my mom's chicken and rice is really the most profound expression of home for me and family that I have. And, you know, when I'm homesick or wanting to share with my children and my parents and my husband, chicken and rice kind of always does it for me. But I've come up with this way to make it work for the way that I actually eat, because chicken and rice is very white.
Yes.
And one of my chapters book.
It's a star in the white food group.
Yes. So one of the chapters in the new book is called Nothing White. So because that's my dad's diet regimen. So I make chicken and rice with brown rice, and I put quinoa in it too. And then my children will eat it like that. But then for me and my parents and Ben, I'll put in like stewed tomatoes and some kind of green, and just to make it less white.
Yeah. It is funny how for my mom, it was, well, two things. It was fried catfish, because we lived near the river. But it was also that chicken and rice, which I've never seen in a restaurant anywhere. I even go to other people's houses, like Southern cooks, and it's just like, it feels like a small thing that just a small groups of people have, you know, make over the time. And when you said, you know, when I heard you talk about it, I heard you talk about it with your mom, I'm like, there's somebody else out there. Because for years, I thought it was something that just my mom made.
No, you know, I think it's actually one of the most common comfort foods in this, at least this part of the South.
Well,
but it's considered so mundane that no one wrote a recipe for it.
Right.
You know, you've got your recipe for fried chicken, you know, but not chicken and rice because it's really only four ingredients.
Yeah. I remember going to some political thing in South Carolina and they had chicken bog, which was pretty similar. Mm-hmm. And we're like, finally, somebody else does make it. I did think of one last thing as you were talking. Do your friends in New York, the people you were buddies with, did they ever call you and say, you know, you can still come back? You know, you can do something here. Now you're well known. Vivian Howard's whatever in New York would be a giant hit. Do you ever have that temptation to kind of go back and check that box?
We've had people offer to invest in places in both New York and Chicago because Ben's from Chicago. But I have no desire. And we opened a restaurant in Wilmington earlier this year.
Sure, pizza place. Right?
Yes. And what that's taught me is that it's really hard to be in multiple places running multiple restaurants. And I worry that I worry about diluting what we do by doing too much of it.
Yeah. And do you feel like the way you see your life now that like Eastern North Carolina, that's a place you plan on staying?
Yeah, we built this really modern house in the middle of the country that's we would never be able to sell it. So, but yeah, no, there's something so powerful about living on like the plot of land that you grew up on and then raising my children there. I can't explain how powerful that feels. And there's no other kind of sensation in my life that is the same. So I feel really connected to that place. I imagine that we'll stay there forever.
Vivian, thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
When Vivian Howard got to our studio, she looked whipped. She'd just gotten off a plane. The day before, she'd been at the state fair with her family, and the morning after, she was going to be the keynote speaker at a charity fundraiser. She was dragging. But she went to the restroom for a few minutes. I think she changed her shirt while she was in there. When she came out, she was fresh and funny and sparkly. It made me think about all those days she's been in front of the camera for A Chef's Life and how many times she might not have felt up for it, but found some way to be the smart and charming Vivian Howard we know from TV. She is a talented chef and a gifted writer, but as natural as she looks on television, she's also a performer. That's not a dig, by the way. It's just an acknowledgement of what we said in our conversation about being a professional. True pros, even when they're ragged, can find a way to shine. Vivian Howard is a true pro. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Della Canal. Our web managers are Jessa O'Connor and Zuri Berry. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. And our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this in every episode of Southbound on the NPR One app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guests. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.